Well, hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. This Saturday afternoon through till 4 o'clock here on Premier Christian Radio. It's the show that aims to get you thinking, that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. And don't forget, we're online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable, where you can find the podcast, the link to the iTunes programme, many features and other resources too. And if you are listening via the podcast, well, you're very welcome too, whenever you're listening in the week. We've got a great show coming up for you today, a real treat, if I might say so. But don't forget that you can check out other past shows at the webpage, and indeed you can find links to things like the Unbelievable Conference DVD from this year, 3 DVDs with some fantastic resources teaching on it from various Christian thinkers. A fantastic present, if I might say, for Christmas, which is not far away now, is it? So premier.org.uk/unbelievable for links to all of those things. Let's hear what's coming up on the programme today.
You're unbelievable.
Well, joining me on the programme today, Francis Spufford and Philip Pullman. A fantastic show coming up for you as we ask the question, does Christianity make emotional sense of the world? Francis is a prize-winning author who, in his most recent book, Unapologetic, explains why he finds his Christian faith to be a compelling way of viewing the world. Philip Pullman is our other guest. He's on the line today, also, of course, a prize-winning author. His latest book is Grim Tales, but perhaps best known for his Dark Materials trilogy, as well as, of course, for being a well-known atheist. So it's a great joy to welcome you both to the show today. First of all, perhaps we could talk to you, Francis. Thank you for coming on today.
You're welcome.
Tell us a little bit of your background, Francis.
I grew up on a university campus in the 1960s with church-going parents, which was much more ordinary at that time, I suspect. Kind of Anglicanism used to go into people's bloodstream, just kind of out of the atmosphere, and it did for me. But I exited it in the traditional teenage way.
Teenage rebellion?
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as that. I mean, it happened years before the whole attempt at the punky hairstyle using only soap as a gel and stuff like that. It was more that that as the world got bigger, as it does when you're 13 and 14, I categorised it as a piece of childhood furniture I didn't need anymore. Mm. And to be honest, I also found... I think I had God quite easily mixed up with various forms of authority I found difficult. So it took me a long time to persuade myself that churches were genuinely empty. And it was only once I was really sure they were empty that I was in a position to start thinking that they might be full.
So it took a bit of time to kind of get over the whole authority issue.
Mm, yes.
And once you were sure that the churches really wielded no authority anymore, you were happy to step back inside, as it were.
There were other things going on in there too, but that was certainly part of it. And one of the things I found immensely sympathetic about his Dark Materials was the way that Philip deals with God as the authority with a capital A, because I certainly never liked that aspect of it.
I mean, people know you for your novels and your books.
I've written one kind of strange half a novel.
Strange half a novel, yes.
I'm a non-fiction writer.
You're a non-fiction writer.
I'm a considerably smaller and less prize-winning person than Philip. Nice though it is to be put in one scale with him in the other scale. Let's be honest.
Well, in any case, I think people might be slightly surprised at the tack you take in your latest book. Mm. What made you want to write this particular book?
It was one of those books which you rather hope somebody else will write, and you sit around twiddling your thumbs because you can see that there's a space where something ought to be. Mm. In particular, it seemed to me that most of the argument going on between belief and atheism was remarkably self-defeating, because people were basically talking past each other, and that to some extent they had bought the new atheist contention that religion was primarily to do with science and with its compatibility or incompatibility with science, whereas in fact the reasons for belief, when I came back to them, had much more to do with emotions. Not that emotions and reason are at war with each other, but there are different domains of human experience there. And I thought there should be a book about religion which was in the domain of feeling, since most of the Christians' I knew were Christians for reasons to do with, you know, their history as human beings, the history of their hearts, in fact, not the history of their attitude to DNA or the fossil record or any of that stuff. So I waited for somebody else to do it, and then they didn't. So I thought, oh, all right then.
Because there have been responses of one kind or another to Dawkins, Hitchens, Dennett et al. But
loads of
nothing quite like this, I hasten to say, which is unashamedly not trying to make some kind of objective, logical, rational argument for God.
There are tiny little bits of pushback in there, because I don't think that there is an objective, logical, rational case against either. But all I want from that point of view is a kind of an empty enough field to talk about what the emotions do. Yes, I am unashamed of that, not because I'm unashamedly saying that emotions are more important than logic, because I'm saying that there is something else to talk about as well as logic, and I'm unapologetic about that.
And in a sense, it kind of makes sense, because although obviously lots of the literature that has come out of the New Atheist movement has branded itself as a sort of rational scientific material, it's also actually quite emotional in its content, I've found.
Yes, though it's difficult to get them to talk about the emotional subtext there. There is a kind of... I'm obviously not pointing this specifically towards Philip or towards Philip at all, since Philip is a novelist who is addressing this in works of imagination, which is exactly where I think it ought to be being addressed. But on the whole, when New Atheists talk about religion, they talk in a kind of almost schizophrenic way. Now, I don't mean that in a proper mental health sense of the word. I just mean in a strongly divided way, as if half the time there was nothing in the world but evidence. I've got a friend who calls some of them the evidence Daleks. They say, evidence, evidence, where is your evidence? But then that dealt with, and it having been, to their satisfaction, proved that religion doesn't meet the standards of evidence, there's then a huge billowing kind of emotional argument as well, and very rarely any self-exploration about where the emotions come from.
Well, we've, as has already been said, have Philip Pullman, which is a great thing to have Philip joining us again. Philip last on this programme when he came on to talk about his last book, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. Philip, thanks for joining us again today.
It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you. You've had a chance to read Francis's book, Unapologetic, Why, Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense. Before we get into that, just a little background for you, for those who aren't familiar with you and your work. You've always seen yourself as an atheist, or was that a journey you made in childhood or later on?
No, I was brought up in a very Anglican home. My grandfather was an Anglican priest. I went to church every Sunday. I was confirmed. I was a member of the choir. I did all that sort of stuff, and I'm very Anglican. In background, it was when I was a teenager. It was the usual sort of intellectual journey, discovering that there were other points of view that I found very exciting. One step on this road was my discovery of the American beat poets, especially Allen Ginsberg's Howl, which hit me like a hurricane, and sort of blew me into a new area of understanding and thinking, and that was the point at which I began to see that the God whose existence I had assumed, I'd sort of taken for granted, really, wasn't necessarily there. And after a lot of confused thinking, which took about 40 years, I found myself writing his Dark Materials, which is a sort of conscious repudiation of the old idea of God. That's why the old idea of God is dispatched in the book. I call myself an atheist, but it depends which perspective you're in. Atheism assumes a sort of knowledge of everything, which I certainly don't assume, so it would be more accurate to call myself an agnostic. But from the perspective of looking at the world and all of human history and everything I can see around me and what little I know of science and so on. I can see no evidence. I can see everything that I can see around me is perfectly explicable without the existence of God.
Mm.
I can put it like that. When I look, when I sort of step back, take several steps back, and look at this little bubble of what I know in comparison with the infinite darkness around it, I can see that, of course, I don't know that. I have to call myself an agnostic. That's sort of where I am now. But I'm certainly not. I'm certainly not one of the new atheists. I like and admire Richard Dawkins. I don't know the other. I knew Christopher Hitchens very slightly, but I don't know the others. Dennett and what's the other chap's name? Sam Hawkins.
Sam Harris. Yes.
Harris. Yes.
The four horsemen. Yes.
But so I'm not one of that group at all. I'm far more sort of I'm with Francis, really. And the thing I liked about Francis's book was that it seems to be another chapter added to the book about religion, which I find most interesting and illuminating, which is William James's The Varieties of Religious Experience. Francis is talking about religious experience, and that's the interesting thing for me, not doctrine or dogma, which I think is largely nonsense, but the emotional effect,
yes,
of feeling connected to the universe, and specifically to a sort of benevolent, all-infusing presence, which might be called God.
Hmm. Well, we're going to get into some of these issues, and interesting you've already raised that you don't feel he talks about doctrine per se. I don't know whether Francis would agree with that or not, but we'll get to that. I mean, just at the very beginning, at the outset, your opening chapter is sort of your opening salvo at the new atheist movement, in a way. You particularly reserve your ire for the atheist bus campaign. This was a few years ago when the buses around London had this slogan on the side, sponsored by the British Humanist Association: "There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." And you talk about, well, what does that hold out to the prostitute, the drug addict that it passes by? And you write, "What it means, if it's true, is that anyone who isn't enjoying themselves is entirely on their own." And later on, "It amounts to a denial of hope or consolation." What particularly got you so riled about that particular example of the new atheism?
Because of the assumption in it that religion has precisely one piece of emotional content, and it's fear. And that the only thing that the thought of the existence of God could possibly hold out to anybody is a threat. One of the amazing things about the new atheist case is how, I think, absurdly time-lagged it is. They are still crusading against hell. And I know that if you are somebody who's got no connection with church and you see those little posters threatening you with undying fire and things put up unhelpfully by the Biblical Text Society, then you might think that Christians are still primarily in the hell business, but you know, we're not really. And I don't know anybody for whom it figures very largely in their religious understanding. So to think of religion as if the main and only thing it did was to kind of menace you with devils with pitchforks seems to me to make an irritatingly flat assumption about how human beings work, as if it was a simple negative. You remove it, everybody bounds out into lovely happiness, of a kind that strikes me as being very like the flatness of commercials, the way that adverts show us punching the air and waltzing in slow motion towards the future if we have brand X of whatever it is. So
it's this kind of simplistic idea that reject religion and all the evils, yeah, and woes will be gone.
We'll
live in this utopia that John Lennon describes in Imagine.
Which is questionable as history, questionable as psychology, very questionable in terms of human experience. And what I wanted to do was use it, you know, slightly unfairly, slightly opportunistically, but hey, it's a polemic, as a way into what else there is there. I wanted to use it as a kind of jemmy to prize open a much larger can of emotions.
And I think that's a fair way of describing the book, a polemic.
Yeah.
Perhaps not unlike the late Christopher Hitchens. You sort of have an interesting way of sort of bringing the issues to the fore, not necessarily just with a sort of a great argument, but with really good writing. What made me want to read the book was that I'd really enjoyed reading it, and if I can make a recommendation on that. But you aren't trying to, as I mentioned, make this case sort of logically for God, but you're saying, well, if you look at the way our emotions interact with the world. Atheism isn't doing it. You're saying there's this gap.
No. Atheism is doing it, partly. The atheist case rests on a set of dignified and important emotions, as I understand it. And my understanding is partly, you know, from inside, because I used to be there. Emotions to do with human independence and dignity and autonomy and a sense of what there is for people with ourselves and each other in an empty universe where we are the sources of all of our own meanings. And yeah, the stuff to respect in there, I don't actually think it fits enough of human experience, but I can see that it does fit some things in an admirable and impressive way. And hey, Christians have a commitment to avoid idolatry, and sometimes atheists can be extremely useful as anti-idolaters, as people to go, hey, that thing you're worshipping over there is a human construct. Step back, people. It's dangerous. And I respect that entirely. If I can get back to Christopher Hitchens for a moment, I mean, I would be delighted if my sentences bounded and zinged the way that Christopher Hitchens do. But I hope that I am a lot less certain than him. One of the things I think is wrong with Christopher Hitchens writing about religion is that he is carried away by the rapturous pleasure of knowing he's right, whatever he turns towards, and God knows his opinion has changed quite a lot over his life. I see religion, and this is where I mean, I'm delighted that Philip thought of William James. I see religion as operating necessarily in kind of deep uncertainty about who we are and what we're for. And I think religion's power is in its honesty about being provisional. I'm not saying we should wake up every morning and go, do I believe in God? Not quite sure, because that's not how we work. But I do think that the way we reach for God ought to be honest about not absolutely knowing. That's what faith is for, I think.
Be interested in your thoughts on this, Philip. As an atheist, do you kind of see where Francis has come from in this book and what he's responding to about contemporary atheism?
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree with him about the atheist past. I thought that slogan was demeaning and stupid beyond words, and I wish I'd had some say in it, because I'd have said, for God's sake, don't do it. Say something else, for goodness sake. It's an absurd thing to say. Likewise with that ridiculous and sickly song of John Lennon's, which I loathe whenever it comes on the radio. I greatly fear we're not going to have much of a disagreement this morning, because I'm with Francis in a great deal of what he says. The sense of not knowing, for example, that is a profoundly important component of whatever we do that's interesting. A true scientist, doesn't know and makes experiments to find out, speculates, imagines. An artist doesn't know precisely what the effect of this colour will be against that when he or she puts it on the canvas. So he experiments, finds out, looks, and then is struck by something else. And it's all a matter of exploration and not knowing. That's a very important component, of a lot of what we do that's important and interesting.
Yes, I want to agree with that profoundly. It seems to me that it's an important part of writing to not know and to be able to sustain what Keats called the sense of negative capability, of being able to sustain that state without reaching irritably...
Without an irritable reaching after fact or reason.
That's the one, thank you. And I've talked to poets who say very much that when a poem is half constructed, it's a question of reaching out patiently towards what you don't know yet.
Yes.
But I think I can...
The thing I feel is that you mustn't put the lights on to look for it.
Yes. I think
it's in the dark, and if you put the lights on, it'll vanish.
Yes. And an appetite for the dark seems to me to be an important part of human awareness. I think I can find a disagreement for us here, though.
Oh, jolly good.
good. It'll make better radio, and I'm not having to manufacture it. Because I disagree about doctrine. I'm not actually opposed to doctrine. It's simply that the order you come to it in seems to me to be important. I don't see doctrine as the enemy of that kind of cloud of unknowing, free-form exploration. I see it as the thing which records lots of other people's honest explorations in the past, and a way to understand the path that experience has taken you on. I have come to Christian doctrine and thought, okay, yes, really, because it fits
Well, this is exactly, I think, the project of the book in many ways. Each chapter deals with what you might say is either an issue or a doctrine, perhaps, in Christianity. So the one of the first chapters is essentially about sin. Now, that's a word which will immediately ring warning bells for many people, many atheists, many sceptics. Now, your sort of approach in the book is to try and recast this in terms of not perhaps using that word. In fact, you use an acronym.
Which we won't
say on air because this is a family-friendly show. But it's HPTFU, the high propensity D2 things up. Okay. Yeah. Now, what you're essentially saying is that this is something that everybody recognises there. It's part of our human nature.
Yeah.
Christians have a word for it. And see it as an issue in the world which needs to be tackled. And so from that perspective, you're saying, I'm not going to kind of make a sort of logical case for this. I'm just saying we all seem to be aware of this issue.
Yes, although we name it in different ways. And I think that the Christian, this is going to sound perverse since I didn't use the Christian name for it in order to get people to see it separate from the way that sin is now strongly associated with lingerie and chocolate. but I think the Christian name for it is important because it comes with a specific, and I think quite kindly understanding of what we ought to be pessimistic about ourselves. I think that messing up, as we shall call it, is built in. And I do think that there are, if I can head over here towards His Dark Materials for a minute. His Dark Materials makes a very powerful case for the value of experience and the kind of the limitations of innocence. It's a part of what makes it wonderful as a children's book is that it is saying that actually growing up out of childhood is profoundly exciting. It's not a process of loss, and the book is essentially arguing it's a mistake to see it as starting clean and getting dirty. There's lots of kind of wonderful stuff from William Blake going on just under the skin of His Dark Materials there, which gives experience a tremendously exciting power. But I think there's something missing in there. There's an extent to which we ought to be more pessimistic than that about experience, that what we grow up into is the full range of human possibilities, including the destructive ones, and that what we ought to see when we look at ourselves is a destructiveness, which is just as much a part of experience as all the good things, and something that we can't disavow without telling ourselves comforting lies about ourselves.
What did you make of Francis's definition of sin, Philip?
I think it's a very good one, and I think it does match very closely our experience of trying to get things right and failing. It's a very good acronym. I won't try to
thank you
enlarge on it, but it does make a lot of sense. And all I say in relation to His Dark Materials is that is one that's one book, but that story isn't over yet. I'm continuing to write. I'm continuing to write Lyra's story, and she's continuing to learn, as I am. So I don't regard that as in any sense a final statement. All literature, all art is really a project in the course of being worked out, which is only interrupted finally by the artist's removal to a higher sphere, which we call death. I am glad to have written His Dark Materials, and I stand by what was in it. But it's by in no sense a sort of final statement about the truth about everything.
Can I add a famished note of kind of eagerness pleased that you do write the next part soon.
I'm doing it now, not as we speak, but anyway. It's open on my desk upstairs.
That would be very multitasking.
There you go. Well,
thank you.
You're in the know now, Francis. We're going to take a quick break and come back because, in a sense, one thing I want to get to is obviously that the next stage, if you like, of this HTPFU sin is that in the Christian conception, there is an answer to it. There is a redemption from it, a way of being forgiven for it. Now, that obviously is, even if an atheist could recognise in common with you that we all seem to have this tendency, they might then obviously say, well, I don't need to go there. I don't need a saviour to save me. Thank you very much. So we'll talk about that in a moment and the way you present Jesus in the book, which I think is very interesting as well, because, of course, that's something that Philip has done recently as well, and we might be interested to have a conversation on that. So you're listening to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. My special guest here in the studio is Francis Spufford, author of the book Unapologetic: Why, Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense. And joining us on the line, Philip Pullman, who's also, of course, a well-known author, and he's interacting with more than a well-known author.
Thank you.
I'm getting signs here from Francis to say, don't even put me, I am not worthy to gather the crumbs from underneath his table.
hang on a second. I've used different language from that, I think.
Someone whom Francis holds in high esteem, Philip Pullman, joins us on the line and is, of course, a very well-known author himself. So we're going to be going to the second part of today's programme in a moment's time. I'm Justin Brierley, and you're listening to Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back. This is Justin Brierley, and if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on today's programme, then do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll be hearing some of your emails towards the end of today's programme. We're also on Twitter, @UnbelievableJB. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is the Facebook page. You can keep updated on what's happening on the show and various other things via the social media networks. All of the links, of course, available from premier.org.uk/unbelievable, where this show is available for download and listening back and many more besides. Well, today on the programme, we're asking, does Christianity make emotional sense of the world? Francis Spufford is our Christian guest. In his most recent book, Unapologetic, it essentially explains why he finds Christianity to be a compelling way of engaging your emotions in the world. Our emotional response to the world we live in seems to make sense in the light of the things that Christianity says about the world. Philip Pullman is on the line and interacting with Francis on this one. And we want to talk about Jesus, the way Jesus comes out in the book, Francis. Well, a note I should say is that you're by no means a quote-unquote Christian author, OK? You're not part of the Christian book publishing sort of area.
No.
And I should probably give a word of caution to those for whom perhaps a little bit of sweariness is a deal breaker. There is a bit of sweariness in the book, and so if that's a problem, you might want to avoid. But if that's not a problem, I found this really interesting, just very different, and a new approach to tackling some of these issues.
Thank you. Let me do the sweariness for a minute before we head off towards Christ. Not that we have to head off there exactly. The sweariness is in there for a number of reasons. It's partly because, you know, I'm not a Christian author. I'm an author who's a Christian, and it seems to me that a lot of our talk about religion happens on unhelpfully in a kind of little zoo of polite tones of voice, which makes it all too easy for other people to dismiss us. And although swearing is a quite crude way of indicating that you don't want to be on the reservation, you want to be out in the rest of the rest of the world's chatter, it seemed to me to be good enough. So
you're not the kind of person who tends to liberally sprinkle it in your own conversation, per se.
I do a bit, but I'm on the radio, so it's partly that it's to do with my natural speaking voice, and polemic should come from your natural speaking voice. And it's partly that, you know, talking about I'm English, I'm an Anglican, talking about religion is embarrassing, and sometimes a bit of swearing is the thing which gets you charging towards the wall of embarrassment and pole vaulting over it. Jesus, I think we should
talk
about
it. So let's talk about Jesus. You have a chapter titled Yeshua, and you sort of tell the story of Jesus, essentially, in your own words, and very much lay on it the spiritual aspect that Christians, you know, see in the person of Jesus, what he was doing in sort of coming into the world, redeeming the world, being God and man in some mysterious way. I mean, in that sense, it's very theological, very doctrinal, I would say. But what are you trying to achieve in this? What are you hoping a skeptic is going to draw out from this sort of telling of the Jesus story?
The story, to begin with, is very doctrinal. The meaning is the story. And one of the things I wanted to do is to dramatise a kind of basic historical truth about the New Testament, which is that the Gospels come after the epistles, that people start telling the story once they've worked out, with the help of St. Paul and so on, what and who they think Jesus was. So the story is the story of God among us. That's not just a kind of layer that's been that's been bolted on top. What I wanted to do was to scrub away some of the kind of the rust of familiarity which is there on the story. This is not true if you're a believer. The story refreshes itself. Mm. Nothing needs to be done to the gospel. I'm not saying there's something wrong with it. Mm. I'm saying, though, that if you come to it from outside, then the kind of state of half-familiarity we're in with it now as a culture actually makes it harder to see what's strange and remarkable and even astonishing about it, which is, let me be very basic, the idea of God among us, of a man who is also voicing the kind of the unearthly generosity of the creator of the entire universe, billions of years, hundreds of millions of galaxies, the whole thing somehow concentrated in one wandering rabbi with a beard, as the Life of Brian said, in Judea, AD 33, tea time. That's strangely local as a story, and it is a very odd story, but its oddness and its power go together. And what I wanted to tell is the story of somebody who is also God taking on themselves the weight of human sin and sorrow, because, you know, I believe in the atonement. I'm a doctrinal kind of guy. So it seemed to me that to make that live, as it already does in the Gospels, was a thing worth doing. Mm.
And for you, somehow, in this story of Christ taking on our HPTF view and bearing it himself and allowing us to escape its sort of consequences and whatever, this for you, again, is borne out with the way you emotionally engage with that story and with sin and everything else. It makes sense in that context. You're not kind of, again, laying out a kind of apologetic sort of along the lines of C.S. Lewis about why Christ was who he said he was, you know, looking at the history of the time. But you're just saying, if you just take it as Christianity presents it, it makes sense for me emotionally.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I'm arguing for it from scratch in an emotional sense, but not from scratch in a kind of apologetic sense. I'm not saying, here are the things that support it, here are your historical arguments about first century Palestine. Not doing that at all. What I'm saying is that, for me at any rate, the natural next step after you recognise that the destructiveness is there built into human experience is not just to say, well, we'd better be stoical or we'd better be kind to each other, though both of those are, you know, good things to do, but that there is a human need there which reaches out towards something we cannot provide for ourselves. That for one thing, the injustices we do to each other are often of the kind where we really ought not to be seeking forgiveness from the people we've just hurt, because that would compound it. That would be even worse. I talk about humanity being in a million-sided, multi-generational lawsuit against each other, and that's kind of true on a reasonably tragic reading of human history. And God comes in as the thing that breaks the ice flow, as far as I'm concerned, the person that has the infinite capacity required to take the weight of what we labour and wobble under ourselves, and offers it as a piece of generosity for the sake of generosity, because he is generosity. And my experience of the Christian life is certainly one of burdens lifted, not entering some... Not back to the advert. I've done very little running in slow motion with my hair bouncing in the wind because I've been forgiven. But on the other hand, I'm functional. I'm grateful. I feel up to being alive.
Just interesting your reactions to that chapter on Yeshua, Philip, and how it plays into the way you sort of looked at Jesus in your last book.
First of all, it's a very good story, and secondly, Francis tells it very well. It is what you might call the
authorised version.
The authorised version. Yes, I was looking for something that wasn't quite as stern as that. But,
sorry.
Yes, that's what it is. My take on the Jesus story, and I one of the reasons I gave my book the title I did, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ, and one of the reasons I split the persona of Jesus Christ into Jesus and Christ, and made them two separate figures, is that I do think they're different. There was the man Jesus, who I have no doubt existed and was born in the region we now call Palestine, and lived a short life and was put to death under the Romans for political reasons. And I have no doubt that he did the things that, or many of the things that we're told about, and said many of the things we're told he said. He was a most remarkable man, a most extraordinary man, one of the great geniuses of world history, but a man only, I think. The difficulty for me comes when the God business comes into it. You know, when we hear that he is somehow also the creator of everything. I could never, even as a child, even as a pious child, I could never understand how he could be this, how three could be one. Mm. You know, the Trinity business. There was God the Father, there was God the Son, and there was some sort of mysterious uncle figure who just sort of hovered amiably in the background, called the Holy Ghost, or as we used to call it, or the Holy Spirit. I couldn't understand why they are they different, or they why? I just couldn't get it, and I still don't get it. I get the idea of Jesus. I get the moral power of the stories he told. And I also get why people get cross why Christians get slightly cross when we who don't believe he was God talk about his power as a great moral teacher and say, well, that's all, isn't it? Well, how could he, you know?
It's fair to say, I must mention this because I don't know how thoroughly you went through the chapter after that as well. Philip, but of course, Francis, you do sort of have a few words for Philip in that book when you talk about the way Philip represented Jesus in his last book.
I did notice that.
I have to confess, I only came across this reading through the book after I'd invited you on, Philip, so I had no idea that Francis had personally addressed you in the book. But you do say this, Francis, in the book: all the dodgy and sinister organised religion stuff is concentrated in Christ, in reference to the book, leaving Jesus free to embody the let's be nice to each other aspect of him that, you know, you kind of can't help respecting. Pullman's Jesus ends up as an atheist. He's a really good man.
I plead guilty to polemical exaggeration there, I think. But that does seem to me to be important, because I don't see kind of viable human goodness in Jesus as a moral teacher there. He makes far more sense to me as a spokesman, but dear, this is where Trinitarian stuff gets very tangled, doesn't it? A spokesman, a representative? No. As divine generosity itself articulating something that won't fit sensibly in terms of human society and human language. Jesus is constantly encouraging people to do things that make very little sense in a prudent way. Giving all your things away, turning the other cheek, loving people who hate you, doesn't make a great deal of sustainable sense if it's advice about how to run the good society. Whereas if it's advice about how to emulate a God who never has to worry about running out of love and generosity, it does make sense to me. I was being a little bit sharp there about the Jesus and Christ split, because although Philip's way of doing it is new, there is a long history of going, this is a very strange hybrid figure, and splitting him back into two bits all the way from kind of the Gnostics and the Arians, and indeed Islam. Islam is a religion partly built on splitting Jesus back so that God goes one way and there's a prophet left over who isn't so troubling. And it seems to me that if you do that, you lose the central power of the story.
As you say, from its earliest point, people were responding to Jesus as far more than just a man, a moral teacher. They seemed to immediately start calling him Lord Christ,
yes,
and all the rest of it. And you can't just dismiss that and some say
no.
And
I don't. And I think if you do dismiss it, you essentially shrink him into irrelevance, and that is untrue to the experience of those who read his four biographies and feel directly and personally addressed. And yes, of course, there is a piece of historical unknowing there about the process by which we get from the man crucified in Jerusalem round about AD 30 through to the developed religious understanding of him. We don't know what goes in there, and there is, let me say it as loudly and clearly as I can, a perfectly respectable case for believing the kind of Geza Vermes argument that what we've got here is a misunderstanding. We've got a charismatic Jewish figure who has been repurposed as something else. We can't know that's not true, but we also can't know that it is true, because clouds of unknowing go both ways. We really don't know that Jesus was that. So to some extent, our willingness to believe that he's God or to think of him as a charismatic teacher strangely re-engineered later is an index of the emotions and judgments we bring to the story in the first place.
But the thing, Philip, is that in a sense, when you reimagined this story, you did have the good man Jesus and the scoundrel Christ. And so all those things that you take as kind of being the accretions of organised religion are labelled with this kind of the sinister aspect that Francis mentions there. I mean, is it fair to kind of polarise Jesus in this way and to sort of label one aspect of his character as the church and the things that are wrong with religion and the good bits as the human side of Jesus? Because that does turn Jesus into a humanist, essentially. And I just wonder if you're not, you know, giving us the full story, actually, of what, as Francis claims, that he is in a more rounded way.
Well, nobody ever wrote a book by saying that. What's fair here? How should I be fair about this? That's not how you write a story.
No.
The division actually is more subtle than that. Mm. And I, that's why I had to write a book of, I don't know how many pages it is, 200 or something, 230-odd pages, because I found this split very, very interesting. And actually, Christ is not the repository of all wickedness, and Jesus is not the repository of all goodness. Jesus is very abrupt and curt and cruel in some ways, and the Christ figure is tormented by this understanding that he has, in my story, of the nature of history and the nature of the church that will probably come about. As he says in the final page, if I can thumb my way through it with one hand, he says, I finally see what it is. I begin to see now, says Christ, what it is, this story, you and I. He's talking to the stranger who comes to tempt him, and who the stranger might be seen as the spirit of the future church, if you like. This story you and I and my brother have been playing out. However it ends, it will be a tragedy. His vision could never come to pass, and the vision that will come to pass is not his. And nevertheless, he goes on to see that without the stories he makes up and tells, there won't be a church. So the church, without, this is the tragedy, without the story, there will be no church. And without the church, Jesus will be forgotten. I see it as a tragedy. And I stick by that. The Jesus in my story was as close as I could get to imagining the Yeshua, the Jewish prophet, a genius at storytelling, who wandered the roads of Palestine and was killed. That was as close as I could get. He was a man. Don't forget, a being. Don't forget, who said that the end of the world was coming very soon. He was on a par with these prophets we get in America who say the flying saucers are coming on Tuesday. Everybody come to the top of the mountain. We'll all be taken away to Mars, and we'll all be safe. That's the sort of vision that he had. I'm sorry to put it so crudely, but it was like that. It will come next. And the crucifixion, in a way, and again, I'm sorry to be so crude, the crucifixion was the making of him, because if he hadn't been crucified, he would have had to live with the fact that the end of the world, the kingdom of God, did not come soon. And would never have come soon. And if he'd lived to be 90, it still wouldn't have come. And he would have been one of these increasingly tragic, increasingly irrelevant figures whose prophecies were forgotten because they just hadn't come true. That was the Jesus who was saved from that by the appalling horror of the crucifixion. And that's how the church was able to build on this and make up this extraordinary and marvelously inventive story about his coming to save us all from sin, as if that could ever happen.
Or he wanted something different by the kingdom, and the torment.
Well, he said he will come within the lifetime of those who hear me.
Yes, but he was a man as well as God. He is a
well,
man.
Well, that's very convenient if you say that.
Oh, of course, it's very. Of course, it's. Of course, it's very.
On the God part.
Of course, it's very convenient. But the conveniences are intrinsic to different kinds of storytelling here. And I don't believe that I see the church telling a tragically different story here. It seems to me to be an intelligible kind of outworking of what is there in the preaching. I can see that in some ways, if he thinks the world is ending, that squares the circle of prudence. You can give all your stuff away if there really is no tomorrow without having to worry about tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I think it works as well as a call beyond common sense. And I think that the crucifixion is also a sign beyond common sense of something redemptive, something excessive, something that steps out of the world. I am constantly impressed by how kind of Dostoevskian your sense of the tragedy here is. It reminds me a lot of the conversation that Jesus has with the Grand Inquisitor in the Brothers Karamazov. But I differ with you about where the tragedy is here. Obviously there is a tragedy, but it's the tragedy, I think, in which an otherworldly wisdom and generosity is forced through the ungenerous sieve of human history, with all of the catastrophic consequences we know about, but is never completely lost either. I still see a thread in Christianity, and a very strong thread that leads back to a promise being made and kept.
Okay, that's good, and I appreciate that, and I understand that to some extent. I can emotionally share it, but what about the church? Because the church seems to contradict at every point what Jesus said. Not what Christ said, but what Jesus said. Jesus said, give all your property away. The church doesn't.
The church.
Jesus said, turn your head, if you're struck, let him strike you 70 times. What about the Crusades? And so on.
Hmm.
The church seems to be utterly wrong, utterly un-Jesus-like. It may be Christian, but it's un-Jesus-like.
It isn't only utterly wrong, though, because as well as the Crusades, there's St. Francis. For every dark thing the Church has done institutionally, every grievous breach of Christ's teaching, there are inevitably humanly failing attempts to carry it out, but nevertheless real solid attempts there.
Strangest argues in the book. He points out all the good things that the church will do.
Yeah, but it isn't.
I'm with that, but I would call that human goodness rather than divine divine goodness or anything like that. It is human goodness. The church has been a vehicle for that. But it has also been a vehicle for all sorts of wicked things as well.
But and every human institution is a vehicle for all sorts of wickedness as well. The church doesn't miraculously change human nature. And as well as that, there are specifically dreadful things that the church enables, which I don't at all want to deny here. But there is a dimension missing here. And that is the Christian sense of the church as not just an institution trying to carry out a tradition, but an embodiment, a way in which we try to be Christ and try to be him, most particularly through the bread and the wine, and the attempt, the ridiculous, preposterous attempt to be transformed every Sunday. What a daft idea. But nevertheless, it's there. The call to impossibility and to grace seems to me to be right there in the centre of it. And I don't think that you understand, I don't think one can understand why Christians stick with and have stuck with so obviously flawed an institution as the church without that sense that it's got God in it. And for all our failures, we never quite extirpate God from it.
The church as a community of believers, like-minded, kindly believers, I fully accept and I fully appreciate and admire, and that's the church which I like very much. The problem is, what always happens when you get any kind of organization at all, it gets mixed up with political power, whether it's with a small p or a large p, and that's when it goes wrong.
Isn't this just going back to what we started talking about, though, the HPTFU? You know, and that's essentially what you say in your book, that any human institution will be marred by this propensity to get things wrong. And so that's not to kind of make an excuse for the bad side of, if you like, what the church has done. But you also kind of do talk about the fact that here is an example, a story which somehow also encourages people to give their lives up for the poor sometimes.
Yes.
And sometimes makes, advances in ways that we don't always think of the church. You know, the civil rights movement being led by Martin Luther King, who was a Christian at the end of the day and whose Christianity obviously inspired him to go and make those changes. This is not to say that this therefore proves it's true.
No.
But you're at least trying to sort of put the other side of the coin.
Yes. I think the record of the church is mixed rather than just wretched. And it's a question of how you understand that mixed history. There are things to be proud of in there, but often the things I think we should stand on are not the big public bits of the record, but lots and lots of small examples lost in time and instantly forgotten of people taking leaps of love and trust towards people they have no sensible reason to love and trust. The church is, among other things, like an engine of disaster and authority, is also an engine of risk-taking for the sake of love. And that's why I think it's worth sticking with it, despite everything. Despite everything in my subtitle, I really do mean despite everything, and I want to be as honest as possible about how big the everything is you have to be in despite of.
We're going to take another quick break before we just wrap things up. If you want to get in touch yourself, if anything Francis or Philip have said today makes you want to give your opinion, why not email me? It's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to receiving your emails. Don't forget, of course, this programme is available at the webpage for download, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Many more resources, features and the podcast available there. And links, of course, to where you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, @UnbelievableJB, if you're a tweeting type. But we're coming back, as I say, in a moment's time to just finish up this discussion. Fantastic interaction we've had this afternoon between Francis Spufford and Philip Pullman. Francis is the author of Unapologetic, the book that he's been talking about this afternoon. Philip, of course, well known as an author of an atheistic bent, and so we'll hear what he has to say as we start to conclude today's programme. We'll be back in just a moment's time. I'm Justin Brierley. You're listening to Unbelievable. Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable today with me, Justin Brierley. And if you want to go online and check out what's happening there on the Unbelievable webpage, you'll find links to past programmes and, of course, the Unbelievable Conference DVD. This is the conference that took place in May this year, and we were joined by the likes of John Lennox, Hugh Ross, Ken Samples, Krish Kandaya, Bonnie Yul Kuhn, and others, Michael Green, a veteran of evangelism and apologetics. And it really was about looking at the Christian faith in terms of evangelism and evidence, putting the two together. So if that's your bag, then why not get hold of the triple DVD? Still time to get it in time for Christmas if you know someone who would appreciate something like that. If you're based in the UK, I should say, you'll get it in time for Christmas if you order this week. Premier.org.uk/DVD. is the place to go for Unbelievable, the conference 2012, Reasons to Believe. Premier.org.uk/DVD. Well, come back next week, and what you'll be hearing on the programme is something that's come up already in the course of today's programme. Did Jesus exist? We've spoken today about the historical Jesus. Both my guests, Francis Spufford and Philip Pullman, happy to agree that he really did exist. But next week, the leading figure in the world who claims that he didn't actually exist, Richard Carrier, joins me. Someone I've long wanted to have on the show. Well, he'll be debating New Testament scholar Mark Goodacre, who says that, well, you can dispute the exact details in the gospel, but the fact is Jesus was a real person of history. That is beyond historical dispute. We'll be hearing from the horse's mouth, Richard's mouth, why he says that he doesn't believe in the historical Jesus, and Mark Goodacre responding. Will be a fascinating show next week, same time here on Unbelievable. Right now, time to finish up today's discussion between Philip Pullman and Francis Spufford.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, as we wrap up today's programme, we've been asking, does Christianity make emotional sense of the world? Francis Spufford with me in the studio. His book, Unapologetic, Why, Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense, doing essentially what it says on the tin, making the emotional case for Christianity. I think you describe it as the grown-up, intelligent sort of believability of the emotion. Because what you're doing, I think, overall in this book is trying to say, if all you've read is Dawkins or Hitchens or Harris or whatever, you haven't had the full story. You've had the kind of Sunday school straw man knock it down. It's obviously all daft type of story.
Yes, and very often that comes with the suggestion that Christianity is inherently childish. And what that usually seems to mean is, the last time I thought about it, I was a child myself.
Well, the classic analogy is Santa Claus, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're like someone who hasn't outgrown their belief in Santa Claus.
Or the Tooth Fairy. There is, in fact, a kind of gorgeous, I'm not sure this is fair or not, but I'm going to do it anyway. There is a gorgeously good example of this in Philip's The Good Man Jesus and The Scoundrel Christ. There is a long, lovely, gentle passage about why losing God is like burying a much-loved grandfather. Mm. It's a lovely piece of writing, and it's full of a sense that, you know, I approve of, though I don't share, the dignity of what a life without God can be. No problem at all with seeing the possibility of that. But if you look at it, what it gets its force from is the kind of, you know, the universal experience of burying your grandfather. Everyone does that, and kind of buried in the metaphor there is the idea that losing God is therefore a natural part of growing up. Our growing up as individuals, our growing up as a species too. You know, you leave granddad behind. But God isn't granddad. God is, I think, more permanent than that, and that there are ways to look at him sideways from adult life where you find something quite rich enough and full enough and challenging enough to answer to any of the full-grown expectations of your experience.
I mean, you have a go, and I think it's a valiant go, at trying to capture in words the kind of numinous experience of a religious experience of God. Mm. And you sort of, it's almost, well, you admit that this is all, at the end of the day, could be boiled down to neurons firing, chemical processes. In fact, you describe it, I think, quite nicely. You say, everything I feel by way of hormones and neurotransmitters and nerve fibres. Starting to believe in God is a lot like falling in love, and there's certainly a biochemical basis for that. And I suppose this is, you could say, oh, it's playing directly into the hands of the atheist. It's just, you know, this reductionist scientistic view, that's what religious experience boils down to, and why add this extra layer that God's really there on top of that?
But it's not playing into the hands of the atheists, because they knew that anyway, and we knew that. We knew that anyway. You need to acknowledge this stuff. There are other explanations for how our religion works for us, but they aren't necessarily true, and it doesn't invite them in to kind of roost on our carpet if we say, well, yeah, it could be this, because what... You know, what I go on to say there is that, you know, that doesn't stop your feelings from being your feelings. Everything you feel has a biochemical basis. Just because you fall in love with somebody and exciting things are happening with oxytocin in your hormone system, but it doesn't mean the person you fall in love with is non-existent. Why should it mean that God is non-existent, that there is a physical basis for what you feel? I will say this, though, that my attempts to describe a religious experience are hopelessly inadequate. Failure was built in there. I know that it's a teeny weeny feeble pencil sketch of what I was trying to show, but it seemed worth trying anyway.
I often feel, Philip, that when an atheist hears of religious experience, they will often say, well, I have what you might describe as a religious experience, but mine comes in a sense of awe at the universe or at the wonder of science even, and that sort of thing. I mean, how do you respond to this very ultimately emotional engagement with this subject when people claim to have experienced something beyond just the natural world?
With complete sympathy and a certain amount of understanding. I was very struck with the it's not just biology argument, because it's one I've put forward myself a number of times, to say that it's the argument that the furious atheists use is that X is merely Y, or simply Y, or only Y, or nothing but Y. That's the sort of form the sentence takes. You know, love is nothing more than the movement of molecules in the brain, or something like that. Well, I want to say love is the movement of molecules, but it's also something else. It's also many things. You don't just have to go to one layer and find that the full explanation in that. So when Francis describes his feelings about God as being due to the same chemicals that... Well, yes, he's absolutely right. It is that, but it isn't only that. Because we're embodied beings. We live in bodies. We are bodies. And our bodies are responsible for, I would say, everything of what we feel. But then, you see, I am in a slightly unusual position, because I believe that matter... The real division here is between those who believe in matter and spirit and those who believe in only matter, I think. Now, I believe in only matter, but the difference between me and the pure matter boys is that I believe that matter is conscious. I'm a sort of panpsychist in that respect. That puts me in a very odd position, I know, but that's where I'm coming from. And I do completely understand and sympathize with and admire what Francis says about it, because he's written very, very clearly, despite what he says, and very movingly about his experiences of religion. And I'm most grateful to him for having done that. I do have a sense of these feelings of awe and wonder and so on, but I find them also in poetry, in art, in music, quite almost especially in music. But as well as stories from the religious tradition, which some of which do fire me up in the same sort of way. The difference is I just don't believe there's a God. Another difference between me and Francis, perhaps, is that I am temperamentally, and this is not an argument that I would dream of applying to anybody else, purely me, temperamentally, I don't enjoy ritual. I don't enjoy being with other people who are being transported in some sort of religious way. I don't enjoy being... I don't enjoy singing hymns. I don't enjoy all that church stuff anymore. I used to, but I don't enjoy it. I couldn't I couldn't, even if I did suddenly find myself or gradually find myself believing in God, I don't think I'd ever go to church. I just don't enjoy it.
Well, in that case, I would highly recommend a really dry and ancient edition of the Book of Common Prayer with language which does its grand stuff while leaving you strictly alone, unembarrassed, and and not having to deal with other people. Can I go?
I've got one on my shelf. I read it frequently.
There we are. The General Confession, an excellent way to start any day, I think.
I agree, yes.
Can I go? I want to go back just a tiny bit. I mean, yes, I think I would absolutely agree that love is molecules in the brain, but it's not only that. I would want to add to that that organized religion is social glue, corruptible institution, all of that, but it's not only that. And I'd like to end by saying that I think Christians have a stake in there being better and more intelligent blasphemy. I would like to start a campaign for better blasphemy. And a prime example of how to do it right is Philip Pullman, I think, because there's an imaginative engagement there and a serious sense of what's at stake, which means that good conversation is possible. Most of the new atheist stuff does not constitute good blasphemy because it happens in some purely pragmatic realm where the evidence Daleks rule, and I would much rather be talking to Philip.
Well, it's been a pleasure to listen to you both this afternoon. Philip, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to talk to Francis again, whose book I admire very much, as I do his book Red Plenty, which I haven't... it's a most extraordinary and unusual book, and I very much enjoyed it. Mm. Thank you, Francis. I'm a great admirer.
Thanks, Philip.
It's the Mutual Appreciation Society here, but rightly so, because it's been a fantastic discussion. And so thank you, Francis, for coming in. If you want to get hold of any of Philip Pullman's books, of course, you can go to his website, and I'm going to put a link with the podcast of this programme to both my guests. So just the website to remember is premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And if you go there, you'll find links to Philip and his books, but also, of course, to Francis and the book Unapologetic, which we've been discussing today. What's been the general reaction, Francis? Are people kind of scratching their heads who know you for your other books and saying, well, this is a bit odd, but or have you had a sort of, a sympathetic reaction?
There's been a bit of head scratching, but most people seem to think that even if they're taken by surprise, it's kind of compatible with what they knew about me anyway. There's been a little...
You've played your hand now.
A little bit of kindly indulgence manifested by some of my friends, but others, others have been, very, very, very generous.
Good. Well, thank you for joining us today and for your generosity, and Philip as well, in engaging in this discussion today. Again, Unapologetic, available, of course, from all good bookstores and online. So thank you for listening. And if you'd like to respond to anything you've heard on today's programme, the usual method applies. And I will be giving out the ways to get in touch in a short moment's time. And we'll be looking at some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. For now, my thanks again to Francis and Philip. You're listening to Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I hope you agree with me. That was a really, really interesting discussion. You can email, of course, your responses to today's show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And we're going to be getting into a few of those. The podcast has received an awful lot of response because I put out the full debate that happened in Oxford University between atheist Alex Gabriel and Christian speaker Peter Hitchens. Well, whatever you think of Peter Hitchens' political views, he always makes for an interesting speaker, an interesting debater, and this was no exception. But what most of you have decided to write in about is the atheist speaker, Alex Gabriel, and particularly the way he decided to start up the debate in his opening speech. The topic of that debate was whether Britain will be better off when it stops being a Christian country. Well, a lot of you responding to the fact that Alex had a lot of criticism for Peter Hitchens in his opening statements and the way he said that. If you want to sort of understand where people are coming from with this, I'd recommend you go back and listen to the programme if you haven't already, available at the webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Here's Derek, who says, I'm an atheist, Justin. However, I had to give up listening to the debate you put out on the podcast this week, as the atheist speaker was just so embarrassing. What a shame. There are so many worthwhile and thoughtful things that could be said about the benefits of a secular society. What a pity the opportunity was wasted. David Robertson, no stranger to this programme, says, I'm not sure whether to thank you for the podcast featuring the debate between Peter Hitchens and Alex Gabriel or not. On the one hand, the triumphalist within me rejoiced to hear such an incompetent defence of atheism. On the other, the Christian within me felt that it was slightly unfair to my atheist friends to be represented in such a manner. I've never heard in my life such an arrogant, ill-prepared and rude presentation as that of Alex Gabriel. At first I thought it was a caricature, but then I realised this was serious. I listened for 40 minutes, during which Mr. Gabriel said virtually nothing to do with the actual debate and had to be continually warned by the moderator to stick to the point. In fact, it became so embarrassingly childish, boring and cringeworthy that for the first time ever I had to switch off an Unbelievable programme. This debate was not worthy of Unbelievable. And considering David's someone who sometimes gets accused of those sorts of things himself, there you go. Daniel says, I found it a little ironic that Alex Gabriel seemed to support Hitchens' opening point by the manner in which he interacted. Don Mower says, didn't care for the smarmy, tactless, smarter-than-thou self-assured tone from Alex, myself, but I've come to expect as much from the atheist intelligentsia in the university setting. That type of attitude is nurtured, coddled and groomed in such places. Some people are just educated beyond usefulness, in my most humble opinion. And here's another person who was there at the debate and wants to give his point of view, Peter Byram, who says, you know a debate opponent has done something seriously wrong when Peter Hitchens treats them with mercy and gentleness. Alex Gabriel was a disgrace. He opened his side of the debate with a barrage of personal attacks against Peter Hitchens, persisting even in spite of the moderator's instruction to remain civil and to address the motion. His comebacks, such as civil, oh, as only war can be, were clearly intended as rhetorical zingers, as if he'd been practising to impersonate popular atheist speakers like Ricky Gervais or even Peter Hitchens' own late brother, Christopher. Sadly, this made Alex come across more like David Brent. After the personal attacks were over, Alex then proceeded to completely derail the debate topic. As one questioner observed, Alex said nothing relevant to the debate until the last 10 seconds. Instead of addressing the social impact that Christian belief has actually had on the UK, he proceeded to complain about verses in the Old Testament and the character of God. This was quickly dispatched by Peter Hitchens, who explained what any biblically literate person should know, that just because an action is recorded in the Bible, it doesn't necessarily mean that the Bible is therefore commanding you to do it. Perhaps the most astonishing admission from Alex during the Q&A, however, was that he wasn't even treating his opposition to the motion as a truth claim, but as an emotional expression. However, despite the appalling performance of this representative for the Oxford University Atheist Humanist Secular Society, Alex does deserve credit for the candid and open manner in which he described the abuses and suffering he'd endured during his upbringing. These have blatantly left emotional scars on him and have affected his entire perception of Christianity. And it allowed Peter Hitchens a more tender-than-usual moment to encourage Alex to discover Christianity beyond the unfortunate version he'd experienced when he was younger. We have to face the reality. There are many new atheist fundamentalists, which we have played a role in making. Sometimes people like Richard Dawkins need only welcome them in after the Christians in their life have already driven them to his door. Thank you, Peter. Sorry I didn't have time with the number of emails I'd like to get through today to read the entire email. Steve, on Alex's contribution, says, I really enjoy listening to Unbelievable. I'm sorry that I have to criticise the show again. The last time Steve got in touch was after the Did Muhammad Exist episode, which had some similar responses. You say, Alex Gabriel not only failed to make any insightful or intelligent contribution to the debate, but was a nasty, small-minded and ungracious debater. I'm not sure what he was trying to achieve, but launching into an ugly, personal and vindictive attack from the very start was unpleasant listening and, frankly, sickening. Surely there are better quality debates in your archives somewhere. Well, obviously, the consensus seems to be on all sides that the quality of the debate, because of Alex's opening remarks, was not up to scratch. But I still thought interesting to air, nonetheless. Obviously, everyone has a right to turn off a debate if they're not enjoying it. I'm sure Alex will maybe want to respond himself as to why he decided to begin his contributions on that debate in the way he did. And I'm very happy to read that out on this programme as ever. Can't read all the responses, though, because there are other things, other interesting emails that have come in to past programmes. The week before, we were talking about the argument from morality. We were looking at that with Angus Ritchie of the Contextual Theology Centre. And atheist Carl Jones was on the line. And so we were asking, can we, as it were, have morality without God? Not can we be moral. That certainly wasn't what Angus was saying. He wasn't suggesting that atheists can't be moral people. But is there a foundation for moral goodness, right and wrong? Moral realism is the way that Angus put it. Well, Amigo Japan, who's an atheist out in Japan, says, I was pulling my hairs out in the last show. Why didn't you invite a subjective moralist like myself to have an opinion? So many things I could say on this topic, but I guess I can summarise it with this. Morality, or rather ethics, are man-made. We are the moral lawmaker. Morals are dictated by the strong. For example, many Americans think it was right to drop atom bombs on Japan. And morality is no better now than before. People's way of thinking has just changed. So, obviously, Kyle didn't say he was an objective, sort of believed in objective morality, but sort of looked at the argument from the point of view of if there were an objective morality, to some extent. This is Mike in Toronto, says, you know I love your philosophical shows, but this one had me pulling my hair out. Two people with less hair after that show, it appears. What is so frustrating is the response to the moral argument by atheists, which is that there isn't one. Not only is no answer given to why there are ultimate moral truths, but the question is considered irrelevant. Atheists are unable to understand even theoretically how the existence of God answers the questions. I was hoping a show dedicated to the moral argument would get into the nitty-gritty of the issues, but all we got were two philosophers talking past each other, neither being able to break through to the other. The Christian philosopher needed to employ, in my opinion, better examples in order to connect with the atheist argument or lack of argument. The first problem is that using Hitler, the Nazis and the Holocaust, or torturing babies as moral absolutes is just too politically and emotionally charged. No one's going to go on record saying torturing babies is okay. Just feels we need to readdress the issue there, says Mike. A few people also got in touch saying, hey, you've missed a trick here, Justin. The person you need to get on from the atheist perspective is a guy called Alonzo Fife, who is an advocate of something called desireism. And I think the idea is it kind of claims to show where you can get a sort of objective morality without any sort of need for anything supernatural. I did try to get hold of Alonzo for the programme. Unfortunately, it just didn't work out with timings and that sort of thing. But I have made a promise that next time we do this subject, because I've had repeated requests for Alonzo Fife to be featured, we'll make that happen. Okay, we won't do another debate on the moral argument without getting Alonzo Fife involved in some way. Doug Douglas says, I subscribed to your show several months ago and really enjoy it. I'm from a little town in North Florida, deep in the Bible Belt, a solid conservative community. Having said that, it's safe to say the Bible Belt is rapidly deteriorating. Should that be unbuckling? I don't know. I want to comment on something the atheist gentleman said on that programme about the moral argument. I don't remember his name, but he said, in America, we're always evangelized. Well, I think that statement's one of the most far-fetched I've heard in quite some time. Here, we're constantly bombarded with the most blatant and callous anti-religious propaganda you could find. It's taught in our schools, even here in conservative North Florida. We're sued for displaying crosses, sued for praying. Our public TV and radio constantly denigrate the Christian community. It's nearly a running battle with Christianity in full retreat, as can be seen in our last elections. Well, there you go. Maybe time for one more. Nathaniel in Alabama says, on this past Saturday's show, it seemed as though Kyle had an objection to your Christian guest based on epistemology. I kept hearing Kyle use the language of reasonableness. And I think I'm gathering that Kyle is trying to say, I don't need an explanation for the existence or grounding of objective moral values to know they exist. If this was Kyle's point, I think he's correct in that we don't need absolute certainty to know that these objective moral values exist. However, We heard your Christian guest point out that once we begin enforcing our moral values on other people, then the question of how we gather our moral understanding and if we've gathered it accurately becomes an important question. For it doesn't seem reasonable to press particular moral values on other people when we have differing levels of warrant or reason for varying moral values. And if we're going to enforce certain moral convictions on other people, it's most important to know whether or not those moral values are real, i.e. grounded in reality, or if they're merely made up. Which is sort of what we were talking about, really, wasn't it? Thank you very much. And there's been more on that. Sorry I didn't get to them. I'll try to read out more same time next week. That's all for now. Thank you for listening to today's show. Hope you can come back again next week. Look forward to having you with me. And don't forget, with Christmas just around the corner, you may want to get your hands on Unbelievable, the conference on DVD for the apologist in your life. premier.org.uk/DVD if you want to do that. That's enough, though, for today's show. Time to hand on to the team at Hip Rock UK here on Premier Christian Radio. But come back again next week for Unbelievable. This is what you'll be hearing.
You're unbelievable.
Richard Carrier, one of the foremost proponents of the Jesus was a myth hypothesis, is with me here in the studio next week. So he's going to be in conversation with Mark Goodacre, who's New Testament scholar out at Duke University in the States. Mark says, well, you can dispute aspects of the Gospels, but frankly, it's balmy to say Jesus never existed. We'll be hearing their debate this time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable. Hope you can come back. Until then, have a good week.